Welcome back to Is It Horror? This is Season 2 bonus episode for Sandman.
I'm Brianna.
I'm Joe.
I'm Matt.
I'm Mitz.
And I am Steve. If you haven't joined us before, each episode we analyze a piece of media, usually a movie, whose horror status is debatable. We look at the creator's intent, audience reception, and the content of the media, all in an effort to better define the horror genre. If you agree with our take on things, awesome. If you don't, that's awesome too. Horror is a diverse genre, and all are welcome. And before we get into discussing Sandman, we're going to go to Joe's Get to Know You Corner. Joe?
Welcome to the corner. So today we're talking about Sandman, and dreams are a pretty interesting thing. And I was just curious, what is your most memorable dreaming experience that you are willing to talk about, be it a vivid dream, reoccurring, or nightmare, or other?
Well, I am always having recurring dreams about my grandmother's house, and it's really bizarre because sometimes it's like I'm third person watching things happen, like memories replay, like we had Christmas and Thanksgiving and like a lot of family gatherings there, and plus I lived there during college. But other times it's like it's almost like it's a different timeline, like I'm me but I'm different and no one is the same, but we're all in the same house doing the same things that I remember us doing, and it's really, really bizarre. So I'm kind of hoping that that means that I'm either astrally projecting or like maybe remembering or living in my alternate universe timelines, because my brain's this really weird little cluttered space and it gets very strange in there. So that's mine.
Nice. Mine is, I don't know, it's not really a nightmare or, I don't know, it was just sort of vivid, and it's one that I've remembered for several decades now, I guess. I don't remember exactly when I had it first, but, well, I only had it the one time, but it was very vivid. So it was like, I was walking down like the side of my childhood house, and it was just a lot of very kind of clear images of what that looked like, the trees, the like air conditioner unit, the sidewalk, and like our dog. There's a really low like white noise coming or starting, and it just like kept building and building and building until it was like all I could hear, and then like I was suddenly wide awake in my bed, and it was just a really kind of weird experience. So yeah, I don't know what any of that means, but it was weird and I've remembered it for a long time. So that's mine.
So for me, there's not really like a lot of specific experiences, and it's probably pretty boring, but I have had recurring dreams always of being able to fly. And so that just always, but it always happens the same way. Like in the dream, I'll be like jumping and then I'll like slowly be able to like hover in the air longer until I can like actually fly. So it's kind of weird that it's always that same way. Probably there's some deep meaning or trauma behind it or something. But yeah, that's the reoccurring dream that I have.
So I have a reoccurring nightmare that I've had since probably middle school of witnessing a plane crash. And I don't know where it comes from, but I have always been terrified of witnessing a plane crash. It's turned from a reoccurring dream of me watching a plane crash into like the ocean or a building or something like that to it's kind of manifested in real life where I really don't like watching planes fly anymore. And it's funny because the dream is never that I'm in a plane crash and I'm not afraid of flying myself. And I think that like everybody who's millennial or older probably has some fear of low-flying planes, but I think my fear of planes, watching planes, is amplified by the fact that I constantly have dreams of watching them crash to the point where I'm like convinced that I'm gonna watch a plane crash before I die. Kind of weird, but that's my irrational fear.
Interesting.
For me, it's funny because there's, I guess, just a couple thoughts with that is I do have not necessarily a reoccurring dream of flying, but I've definitely had some of those. types of dreams, but whenever I do fly in my dreams, it's always at a ridiculously slow pace. Like, it's, I can fly as fast as someone taking a leisurely walk, and that's it. So I always think that's kind of weird. And then I had this really vivid dream when I was, I don't know, late teens, early 20s. And it was like I was going to interview these people that put together a website that was supposed to be an anti-suicide website. So it was like supposed to be designed to help convince people not to kill themselves. Which sounds good, except for, so I go to interview them, and it's in this extremely dark room, has like the standard horror movie, like white and black tiled floor. And so we've just kind of got like two chairs in the center of this room, and it's dark enough on the outskirts that you can't actually see anything. So it's kind of like fading to blackness in all directions. And then there are racks of clothes kind of surrounding us. So I'm interviewing the person that put together this website. And they'll be like, yeah, so we don't want people to kill themselves in this way or this way or anyway. But then they'll slide a rack of clothes out of the way to show a horrifying but realistically depicted means of someone killing themselves, like hanging themselves or slitting their wrists or something like that. Then they'll slide it back. And so it seemed like the website was just detailed showing someone how they would kill themselves, but then just at the end of it being like, don't. And it was really strange, and I will probably remember it till the day I die, because, I don't know, I just, one of the things I try and do sometimes is, like, if I do have a weird dream, try and write it down, and I don't always do that, but, and it's not always vivid, but, so that's one that I wrote down, so I don't know, that probably helped really burn it into my memory, but, yeah, so there's my weird, long-remembered, vivid dream.
I have a random question for everybody. Can anyone, or does it feel like you can read words in your dream and or hear music?
Yes, but it's never right. It's like you put on a CD that you know by heart, and it's not right. It's like not the right songs.
Really?
You know? That's what I get.
I don't think that I have really any memory right offhand of hearing music while I'm dreaming or necessarily trying to read while I'm dreaming. I've heard that you can't read while you're dreaming, like it's that side of the mind doesn't work that way. Are you able to? I'm curious now.
So I don't know if I can, but I feel like I can. Like I have very vivid dreams where I'm looking at a book and I am reading a book. And I am definitely asleep, but I am reading a book. So I don't know if, like, my brain's telling me that I'm seeing words and just making that up, or if I'm actually reading something that was somehow visually captured. I don't know. It's just, I also heard that, like, you can't read in your dreams. You aren't supposed to be able to hear music, like you said, Mitz. Like, it's kind of, it's wrong somehow. But I can absolutely, I have very clear memories of hearing music in my dreams.
I can't recall a time when I was seeing words, but I've definitely heard music in dreams. And I've also definitely felt, like, physical feelings, I guess. Pain and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I wake up, like, knowing that I felt pain or something else, and obviously I didn't, but it feels like I did.
One of the things I always find interesting, and I don't know if this is, because I think as humans we're terrible at basically categorizing what things, what experiences are universal and which ones are not. So I don't know if this is universal or not. But anyway, one of the things I think always happens to me is if I have a dream where I am going to die, like someone's about to kill me, then something always happens to intercede so that I don't die in some way. So it's like either it's, oh, I was this person in the dream, but they're about to get killed, so now I'm not. Now I'm just a third-party observer. Or, oh, this thing was going to kill me in the dream, but then physics stopped working, and whatever it was, the bullet, the car, the fall, or whatever, stopped working the way it's supposed to, and I was fine. I don't know if any of you have
That's interesting. I've totally, like, it's like the ending of a video game, like, wah, 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 but I've definitely died in dreams. And had, like, that phantom pain that happens. I remember, oh my gosh, this one time when I when I was real little, I might have been in grade school, I had this dream that I was in this big library and there was this gigantic marble staircase that like went up into the air like infinitely, like one of those weird, I don't know, surreal M.C. Escher kind of deals. Anyway, I climbed to the top of this because I'm getting my book because, you know, nerd. And I fell, and I remember in the dream I was falling in slow motion, but there was, whatever this library was, I knew the floor was marble, like it was a stone of some kind, and when I hit that marble floor, I heard my bones crunch in the dream. It was so gross. It was so gross. It was very vivid. I didn't feel any pain, but I heard it. It was gross.
See, that's like, this is like a segue into our topic, but stuff like that. That you've never experienced, but it's so real. Because I dream really vividly, too. It's like, how could that not be real? How could that dream not have been in an actual, like, dimension? You know what I mean?
I don't know. A REM cycle is a hell of a drug. Who knew?
Something's going on there, man. Dreams are real.
Yeah.
Well, don't forget that things need not have happened to be true. Tales and dreams are shadow truths that will endure when mere facts are dust and ashes.
Can I just tell you that that was some stuff I would have written in whiteout on one of my three-ring binders in high school so hard. You have no idea. Like, there would have been flowers and vines around it. Oh, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I guess with that good segue, unless you had anything you wanted to wrap up on the corner, I guess we can get into the actual episode.
Yeah, no, that's great.
All right, well, this is our first time covering both a TV show and covering a comic series. And so both with serialized media, it's a little bit different. We'll get into that. But I wanted to at least talk just a brief second about the Sandman series, the comic series, before we get into the TV show. So the Sandman series ran from 1989 to 1996. And that's talking about the Sandman series proper. There have been other editions and one-offs and things since then, so it's not, that run isn't the only part of it that exists. But I thought it was interesting at least to talk a little bit about the history of it, because it was originally published through DC Comics. You had this editor there that worked for DC whose name was Karen Berger, and she'd worked for DC since 1979. And then in the mid-1980s, she began recruiting writers from the UK. Sometimes when you talk about comics, people refer to this as the British invasion, at least for comics. And so she was recruiting these people that had kind of the same sort of artistic sensibilities that she did. And so you had people that were people like Jamie Delano, Peter Milligan, Grant Morrison, and of course Neil Gaiman. And they, along with Alan Moore, who'd already been working some for DC, they wrote series like Animal Man and Doom Patrol, Shade, The Changing Man, Hellblazer, Swamp Thing, and then also, of course, the Sandman series. And so people kind of referred to this as the Bergerverse because all of this initially was kind of, you know, under her stewardship, and it was under the DC label. But eventually, these things became the foundation for the Vertigo imprint within DC Comics. And it took a little while for this to happen, mind you. So Sandman, the first Sandman issue that had the Vertigo label wasn't until issue 47. So it took a little bit for that to happen. So at least when you read through this series, some of the early issues of some of those runs have, you know, references to the DC universe and superheroes and stuff in them. But after a while, it occupied its own space and didn't worry about trying to connect up to any of the rest of these things. So it's probably a little bit strange, for at least for some people, reading some of those early issues of Sandman and seeing people like Martian Manhunter and stuff like that in there. So it was written by Neil Gaiman, and then it was drawn by a lot of different artists, but at least those early few issues and the ones that we're specifically going to be dealing with, the main artists on it would be Sam Keith and Mike Dringenberg. Sam Keith, so the creator, writer, artist of the Max series over at Image Comics. He also has worked on both Batman and Lobo and plenty of other things too, but those are the main things, the big comics that people think of with him. And then Mike Dringenberg, he also worked on Doom Patrol and co-created Flex Mentallo with Grant Morrison, which is pretty cool limited series if you've read that. And then he also did a lot of Magic the Gathering cards. And if you've probably already seen on our Instagram, if you were following us on Instagram, just talked a little bit about Cinnamon Hadley, who is a friend of Mike's living in Salt Lake City. And, you know, there's a couple of us here on the podcast that are from the Utah area, so it was kind of cool just seeing that, you know, he'd been here also, but then he was inspired for the visual look of death after this friend of his, Cinnamon Hadley. Just a particular quote on it, just because I found it interesting anyway. He says, none of the characters are direct renderings of individual people. They're composites emerging from my memories. Case in point, while my friend Cinnamon was a primary visual inspiration for death, she was never actually posed for me as the character while I worked on the series. Most of the time, my girlfriend, Javette, and my friends, McGann and Nisa, actually posed, and they each brought their own personalities to the task. But still, it was just kind of interesting because just seeing some of her life story and places that she lived nearby. So I don't know, it's kind of interesting character to read about, especially if you happen to be from the Salt Lake area. But yeah, there's so many interesting things. Of course, with Neil Gaiman, he's worked on so many different things. We've already talked about Coraline in the series, but we'll mention a few other things here in just a sec. But I will turn it over to Joe to talk about the TV series.
Cool. Yeah. The Sandman 2022, developed for TV by Neil Gaiman, David S. Goyer, and Alan Heinberg. Neil Gaiman, obviously, we were talking about a little bit already, did Coraline, which we've talked about, like Steve said, Stardust, American Gods, Good Omens, books and TV show with Terry Pratchett, Doctor Who, Miracle Man, and then with David S. Goyer, his stuff was Dark City, Blade Trilogy, the Dark Knight Trilogy, Man of Steel, Batman vs. Superman, the Constantine TV series, depending on how you pronounce it. I've always pronounced it Constantine, but yeah.
I like Constantine, like Matt said. That has a ring to it.
Yeah.
It has like a British feel. Constantine.
It's very, like, I don't know, debonair, like Constantine. Like that person has a martini and a cigarette for sure.
Oh, definitely.
It's like aluminium. It's just more satisfying.
And then Alan Heinberg, writer on Wonder Woman, Grey's Anatomy, The Catch, Sex and the City, Party of Five. As far as writer for comics, Young Avengers, JLA, Crisis of Conscience. And then, so for the Sandman series, back of the box description, after years of imprisonment, Morpheus, the King of Dreams, embarks on a journey across worlds to find what was stolen from him and restore his power. Episode 1, while searching for an escaped nightmare in the waking world, Morpheus falls prey to Roderick Burgess, an occultist looking to summon and imprison death. Yep, that's where we're going to start.
And as always, huge spoiler warning for everything. We are specifically going to be talking about the first volume of Sandman because there's different print options that you have available as far as Sandman goes. The first volume that we're looking at is the 10-volume trade paperback version of the series, which encompasses the first 8 published issues. And then we will be talking about the correlated episodes of the Sandman TV series, which includes the first 6 episodes of the TV series. So if you want to follow along with us, that is what you would need to have seen and have read in order to not be spoiled on anything we're going to be talking about. And then going into this a little bit more, because there's more history with the comic series, there is an afterword by Neil Gaiman that talks about basically the intent of the series, whether or not he considered it a horror. And that was contained at least in the 30th anniversary version of Sandman Volume 1. So I figured I'd read some of those quotes because they were pertinent. The first of those says, "I had never written a monthly comic before and wasn't sure that I would be able to. Each month, every month, the story had to be written. On this basis, I wanted to tell stories that could go anywhere, from the real to the surreal, from the most mundane tales to the most outrageous. The Sandman seemed like it would be able to do that, to be more than just a monthly horror title," which that doesn't necessarily in and of itself say whether he considered it horror, but at least that it could have been just horror in maybe another person's hands. But then There's another section where he talks specifically about each individual issue and some of the inspirations and the tone he was trying to strike. And for that one, he says, "There was a definite effort on my part in the stories in this volume to explore the genres available. The Sleep of the Just was intended to be a classical English horror story. Imperfect Hosts plays with some of the conventions of the old DC and EC horror comics and the hosts thereof. Dream a Little Dream of Me is a slightly more contemporary British horror story. A Hope in Hell harks back to the kind of dark fantasy found in Unknown in the 1940s. Passenger was my perhaps misguided attempt to try to mix superheroes into the Sandman world. 24 Hours is an essay on stories and authors, and also on one of the very few genuinely horrific tales I've written. Sound and Fury wrapped up the storyline, and The Sound of Her Wings was the epilogue and the first story in the sequence I felt was truly mine and in which I knew I was beginning to find my own voice." So he clearly at least considered his original comic series for several of those issues to be horror, at least in his opinion. As far as meta tags go for the TV series, it's a little bit different with this one because you can't go to other streaming services to see what they labeled it because this is a Netflix original. But you have at least four places where it's referred to as fantasy, four where it's referred to as drama, one that refers to it as supernatural horror, one as superhero, and one place that just referred to it as plain old horror. So there's that aspect of it. And then for the comic, I thought this was a little bit more interesting because there's at least a couple other options. You had Comixology is the place I saw most of the labels that they put on that, and you have Google Play, which offers it too, so there's an option there. But they described it as things like fantasy, mythology, dark fantasy, sci-fi fantasy, urban fantasy, and of course horror. And then one of the other things that I took a look at is going back to Goodreads, because on their website, as noted in the Jurassic Park episode, people can say what they think the genre for the comic or the book is. And so looking at the 8,000 respondents on there at the time, we had about 64% considered the first volume of Sandman to be fantasy, and then 14.7% considered it to be horror, and then you have science fiction as 9.7%, adventure as 0.8%, supernatural as 3.2%, 2.2% said dark fantasy, and mythology was 4.3%, and adventure 0.8%. So all that to say, about 14% of those 8,000 people considered horror as the genre for the comic series. So anyway, said plenty. So there's at least a little back story on that. I guess the other thing of interest too is talked before about the idea of the October bump that some horror movies get in terms of the comic series. There's no real bump there, and with Netflix, it's too soon to tell since the series has really just started. So all that wordiness aside, where does everybody weigh in the Vertigo series? Let's do the comic series first. Do you think that that is horror or not?
I'm gonna say not horror, but more horror than the TV show, but still not horror.
Yeah, that's where I'm at too. I think it's dark fantasy more than horror.
I think that the comic is horror, so I'm going to say horror. I think the TV show is not horror.
As for the comic, I'm undecided. I am very much on the fence, and it's been a while since I had that answer.
I think for the comic, I went back and forth on this, but I think that for the comic, I'm willing to call it horror. Okay, so where did everybody weigh in then on the Netflix series, or at least what you've watched so far? And of course, that's the case for both the comic too, is what we've watched, what we've read so far.
Nope, definitely not horror. There were a couple elements, like there was a gore element in the TV series, but it was just not enough to push it over the edge for horror for me. Awesome, though. I'm enjoying it immensely.
Yeah, and I agree with what's been said. I think the comic is more horror-oriented. I still am not calling it that, but the TV show definitely not either.
I guess I missed the part where I was supposed to save this, but yeah, I already said the TV show I don't think is horror.
No problem.
TV show, not horror, except episode 5.
I think ultimately I went back and forth on this a little bit too, but yeah, I'm going to say not horror on the TV series. Just, I guess, to echo, I guess, what everybody else had to say, at least on this front, or at least where it has been mentioned, both are excellent. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well worth reading, well worth watching. Well, I figured before we get into the specifics on the show itself, one of the things that I wanted to at least discuss a little bit was, just since this is our first time dealing with serialized storytelling, what different hurdles do you think a serialized story has to overcome to be seen as horror compared to one-and-done stories like a movie or a single video game like we've been covering?
I think that serials really have more of an obligation to build, I don't know, I guess a more solid tension or a more consistent tension throughout a series, rather than like giving you just a 90-minute blood and gore thriller kind of deal. The serialization of any story allows more time so you can create a more intricate storyline, characters, backstories. Like, you just get into this larger, harder, faster, like bigger investment in those who are about to die and or be condemned to hellish madness, you know, depending on what your storyline is.
Like we kind of talked about too, like there is at least an episode and at least an issue or two that I do consider horror, but because it wasn't throughout, I just couldn't bring myself to call either of them horror, just blanketly. Taken on their own, then yeah, sure. But not on the whole, I guess.
So what I will say is that I think for something like a series or a serial comic to maintain the horror is much more difficult, because you can't just rely on cheap scares, like, you know, things that are jump scares or other things or shocking bits, because something that happens, especially myself, as I've played a lot of horror video games, one that particularly comes to mind is Outlast, which probably, if anyone's ever heard of horror in video games, you've probably heard of Outlast, where like the first 30 minutes of Outlast are pretty scary. But then you figure out that the formula is there's going to be a scary thing. You have to sneak by it to grab some stuff. And there's no more horror because you know what the jump scares are coming. You know what's going to happen. So that's the challenge that a serial or a TV series has to deal with, is they have to focus on horror elements that are not instant, that are not instant gratification kind of situations. It has to build tension, like Brianna was saying, over time, and not just rely on the quick scares.
Yeah, I would agree with the statement that it's harder to classify a serialized story as horror, because I guess I'm expecting that horror to be constant throughout, but in this case it's not. But I also don't agree with that, because, I mean, if I were to show episode 5 of Sandman to my mom, who hates horror, and that was her only perception of the entire show, then she would think it's horror. So, I don't know.
I think that there's definitely this thing that happens, and you can see it with long-running horror movie series. So taking, say, something like Friday the 13th as an example, there's 12 installments of that film franchise. And one of the things I think is always a little bit unsettling to anybody is the unknown. The less answers you have about something that's perceived as scary, then the easier time it has to be scary, to be tension building, to feel like horror. But the more answers you have, the more things get explained, the more old hat they become, the less that they have that kind of power. So I think, for instance, looking at the Friday the 13th series again there as an example, by the time you're getting to the 9th, the 10th installment, you're kind of seeing the same thing you've been seeing over and over again. Maybe that's not a good example, 9th and 10th, for that particular series, because both kind of went out there. But just the point being, like, you've seen Jason hack someone up with a machete. You've seen him do some creative kills. You get used to it. So I think that that's at least one of the hurdles that you have to deal with in serialized storytelling with a comic series or a TV series, that you need to still be able to surprise your viewers, readers, in some way to maintain that horror feeling. But if you were just doing the exact same thing year in and year out, I think that you're going to lose some of that. And I think that at least looking at TV series, you can probably see that to some degree in series like The Walking Dead, where they have to try and figure out new things to do. At the end of the day, it's zombies, and it's not to say that that series is horror or not horror, or that it's bad, just that there's that hurdle to overcome because you've got to continually shift your tone over time to kind of keep your viewers on their toes.
I'm going to say this having not watched any of the show I'm about to say, but it seems like a show like American Horror Story, where, like, again, having not seen it, but I think it's probably pretty well considered horror. And my understanding is it's more of kind of an anthology, or at least like season to season, it has to change it every time. But yeah, please correct me if I'm wrong. But if that's right, then it does seem like you have to have the new stuff coming into it every time.
Okay, first of all, homework, go home and watch American Horror Story, please, because the first four seasons are magic. Like, I can't, just magic. Go watch it. It's amazing.
Okay.
You're going to get hooked. Seriously, just start with season one and just keep having someone bring you popcorn and soda.
Okay.
And then the thing I think is kind of cool about that, it is an anthology series, like you say, so each season does cover a different thing. There is an overarching universe where it all kind of connects together, but you're right, it does kind of have to like change the format just a little bit from season to season. Sometimes a lot, sometimes just a little. So they do have to do that to kind of keep it fresh. And I don't know, I like that show a lot. I keep watching it, so.
Yeah, spoiler warning though, not all seasons are created equal. You need to keep an open mind in some areas. Steve and I disagree about Roanoke. Just putting that out.
Okay.
I think everybody disagrees with me about Roanoke because I actually like that series.
It's a good one to argue about.
All right. Well, I guess we touched on this a little bit, but I am curious about this too. I guess because we've talked about this in terms of films, how much of a movie has to be horror for it to feel like horror. So I guess the same sort of thing. And it's not like you can put a number on it, but I guess just to at least have the discussion, do you think that a horror series, that every episode has to contain horror elements? Do you think that it can be like an episode per season, half the season? Or I guess how much of a TV series in a season has to be horror for the show to be horror?
I mean, I think the short answer is yes, because see Penny Dreadful, but I don't know that it's necessary, but it really, like, it does help. I think a series without horror elements in each episode, or at least a strong undertone of horror throughout, tends to sort of lean more towards the drama end of things for me. And I, personally, I want to know that things are scary, flesh-rending, and, like, spooky every step of the way if I'm gonna call it horror.
I think that a show that definitely suffers from that pretty badly is The Walking Dead, where they've kind of boiled horror down to, like, a main character dying. And without spoiling things, it's almost like there's really not much in between the season premieres and the mid-season and then the season finale kind of a thing. So you can you have a textbook example there of a horror series that has a lot of nothing happening in between episodes.
Yeah, I don't know. Thinking about Walking Dead, like, a lot of times I feel like it's more a drama than a horror. Like, I'm not sure it'd be an interesting one to talk about, but I see what you're saying about, like, it getting kind of boiled down. And they'll be like, oh, well, we'll have a zombie jump out sometimes, or we'll have to kill somebody off to, you know, keep making everybody feel like the stakes are high.
Like, I don't want to talk too much about The Walking Dead because that's a whole other thing. But yeah, that show is, to me, just an example of how horror can get stale after a long time. And I know the whole idea of The Walking Dead comic was like, what happens after the zombie movie? What happens 5 years, 10 years after the zombie movie? I think the comic does that well, but the show, yeah, it more just turned into a drama.
So let's dig into the Sandman series itself. how does the tone differ between the comic and the show for everybody?
I think the comic is darker than the show, and maybe that's just because the artwork has a certain aesthetic to it. You know, we've got our 80s goth, or, you know, little emo kids. Yay, Doc Martens forever. But I don't think that the TV show carries that over as much. I think that the TV show has more of a sweeping, epic feel to it. Maybe it's just because it's a moving visual medium as opposed to a stationary, but that's how it hit for me.
Yeah, I think you maybe also get a little more, like in the TV show, a little more things that kind of break the heaviness. Like, I guess the thing that came to mind was having the crow Matthew in there, who just voiced by Patton Oswalt, who's great. Just, I guess, help lighten things up, add some jokes, add some humor into it.
I loved that he was Matthew, because I didn't do much research on the show. And the second the Raven talked, I was like, holy shit, that's Patton Oswalt. Like, my, you know, you get an extra star show. Good job.
I think that this has been said, but I think having the visual of the TV show definitely adds to the fantastical. The comic is already very high fantasy, if you want. I don't know. Never mind. Come back to me. I'm baking my thoughts. Never mind. Just cut that all out. Cut it out.
It's all staying forever.
I'll talk for a second. So, yeah, I feel like, and this isn't necessarily a bad thing, but I feel like in the comic book, Dream just looks different, obviously. He looks not human, and all of his word bubbles are different, and that I think really does a lot for the aesthetic of it, to make it feel otherworldly, whereas the TV show, you know, is just a hot guy that has a really deep voice, and I get it. But I think my brother had also said this too, where it just feels like, I think it would have helped the show feel a little bit more supernatural, maybe a little bit more horror, if he actually looked less like a normal guy.
I wasn't intimidated by Dream in the TV show at that character. Like, I felt, I don't know, more empathetic towards him. And in the comic, the word bubble thing that you mentioned, Matt, that's a huge thing for me, because I'm a visual person. I see the creepy, drippy word bubbles, and, like, his voice gets real deep and gravelly. And, like, I don't know. I didn't get that from the live action.
Yeah, that's something that came to mind for me, too, is just the portrayal of Dream in the comic is definitely this otherworldly, not quite human, off-kilter feel. And then just even in the first episode / first issue, they have him as such an alien sort of creature. Like, he doesn't, and during all the time in his captivity, he's pretty much sitting still. He's saying almost nothing. And there's really, it's hard to have kind of a sense of empathy for him. It's more of a sense of, if anything is fostered around him, it's a fear of maybe the unknown. And there's all those perspective shots where they're not even showing him, they're just showing what he's seeing. And meanwhile, the TV show, right out of the gate, it gives you the introduction from Dream narrating, you know, telling about himself, who he is, what he's doing, and then having the crow introduced and being shot there, it introduces this element of empathy to him. And, you know, hey, whoever this person is, they had a friend they cared about, and they're deeply upset seeing them killed in front of them. And they're just building all that empathy around him. So I think at least the first issue leans on this horror of this unknown, of this, who is Dream? What is Dream? Are they something I should be scared of? Whereas a TV show never really feels like that, other than maybe superficially because of story beats that have to happen, but they don't necessarily feel as much like a thing that this version of Dream would do.
I do agree that Dream is a lot less spooky in the TV show. As far as casting goes, I don't think they could have done better than Tom Sturridge. I wonder how they could have made him seem creepier as he is in the comics. But I would argue that Dream is also pretty empathetic in the comic. As far as I felt like he was, even though he's creepy and he has this foreboding aura around him in the comic, I think he still was humanized. So I don't think that that was that far off.
I guess just to clarify, I don't mean to say that I don't think he's empathetic in the comic. What I mean to say is that the comic takes its time getting to the place where he feels empathetic, whereas the show out of the gate hits it with that.
Especially by the Sound of Her Wings episode, like I felt very empathetic towards Dream in both incarnations so far.
I do agree that he does feel a little bit too human in the show, though. But I don't know how they could have fixed that. Because, like I said, I think the casting was really well done.
I do think that the actor who plays Dream does a really good job. He does portray it well, I agree.
Yeah, I agree that I think he's the right person to cast. It's just such a slippery slope right now with Hollywood as far as like what you want to do with makeup and like CGI kind of stuff. So I do think that they made the right choice in just having him be a guy for the TV adaptation of the show. But it doesn't change the fact that I think it's sort of takes away from what he is and who he is overall.
I think there's a grittiness to the comics, and it's definitely in Dream's portrayal, but it's also just in the whole world. Like the other thing that comes specifically to mind is the portrayal of John, or Dr. Destiny, depending on which. I guess it's John in the comic too, but he calls himself Dr. Destiny, or Dr. Destiny. Yeah. Anyways, but in the comic book, he's like basically a walking skeleton, and I thought it was a little weird that like he's so creepy looking, and then like he walks around and like goes in the diner, and like nobody seems to care or is like at all concerned by his like skeletal appearance. But yeah. Anyways, I just think that's a comment on the grittiness of the comic book world, that its art style that it chose to use.
No, that's a really good point, because that character in the comic was way more scary. They gave me like a trash can man vibe from like The Stand. Like I felt was a sort of frenetic, like hazy, like dangerous energy. And the actor who played Dr. Destiny in the TV series, love him. Can't remember his name, but he's one of my favorite like character actors who I've seen. And like, I felt extremely empathetic towards him at times. Like, dude had a real fucked up childhood. Like, can you blame him for destroying shit on the existential planes? Like, I get it. I really do.
Yeah, I liked his character. Well, I liked his character in the TV show a lot better. And I feel like, and maybe it's just because I didn't read the comic or, you know, whatever comics he was in previous, like the Dr. Destiny character. But like, I actually kind of got a little more a glimpse of who John was. And I don't know, we'll probably get into this more later, but I feel like that was a big difference between the diner episode and the diner issue, is his portrayal and how he ended up doing the things that he did it and his motivations for that.
Yeah, there was far more humanization of characters in the TV show than there were in the comics.
Definitely.
I kind of took his appearance in the comic book as maybe a symbol of how he sort of molds himself or is moldable to the viewpoints of those that are around him in a way. And maybe, you know, he doesn't actually literally look like that in the comics. But I don't know. It's just an idea in my head.
No, I would agree with that. I think that it's the horror version of a musical, right? Like the reality that the people are living in a musical is not really that someone's breaking out and singing. It's just like their inner monologue coming out. So I kind of took, at least in the comic series, the same sort of feel there. And granted, there's no reference I have or necessarily visual cue within comics to say this is exactly the way it was meant. But I took his skeletal appearance to be non-literal, but more as a reference for the audience to get. We get that there's something wrong with him because of his askew frame, but people in the real world are seeing him as a normal human, maybe a bit gaunt, but that's it. But again, that's just, I don't know, my interpretation of it, same as yours.
Interesting take, but you have me stuck on, like, musical inner monologues. You have no idea what's going on in my brain right now. I'm going to sing everything from now on.
Good.
Internally, yes. Of course.
Excellent. I just scream internally, because that usually is, I don't know, it requires a lot less coordination.
I guess, since we're talking about that character, I don't know if this is the right place to talk about it, but I feel like a few things I had about him as far as his motivation, like, I thought it was interesting that they, in the TV show, were like, oh, well, his whole thing is like, let's make sure everybody can't tell a lie, and that's why his thing is his thing, because his mom lied to him and all that stuff. But then in the comic book, it felt a lot more random and a lot more, which I guess for me, that lent a lot more towards horror for me, the kind of randomness of it. And I think that was all summed up for me in how each of those characters handled Rosemary. Because in the comic book, he just is like, well, I'm going to shoot you now. Sorry. Or not sorry. but in the show, he's like, here, I'm not only not going to kill you, here's an amulet that will sort of kind of make you immortal. And there's just a lot more empathy to that. I don't know. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same character, but it's almost like they're two different characters comparing the comic to the TV show, because like you said, in the comic, he's almost just like chaotic evil. You can never really tell what his next move's going to be in those few chapters. He's just kind of creating chaos for the sake of it. And in the TV show, he seems a lot more driven. It almost seems like he really is looking to be good. He gives Rosemary his amulet instead of shooting her because he believes that she is a good person. And even in the diner scenes, it seems like he's doing all of this to bring the best out of people, not knowing that he's actually bringing the worst out of people. So I don't even think the two versions of John are the same character. So I don't know what you guys think about that, if that was a good choice. I thought it was a good choice. I thought that it made John a much more interesting character, but I just wanted to know what you guys thought about that.
Honestly, I agree on both fronts. I think that they are two separate characters, and I think that the change worked for the show. I think that what he was in the comic worked good for that, and it's added to the horror of the element of that particular issue, just with going with the idea of trespassing basically any of the boundaries that he had encountered within society, so each hour pushing it to some other limit, pushing it to some other place, whereas, yeah, you couldn't really empathize with that, why he would do those things. But then meanwhile in the show, they do create a more empathetic character, and you can kind of understand it becomes more of a, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions kind of cautionary tale, as opposed to the sheer chaos of the comic.
Yeah, I agree. I think his motivation in the TV show is really that he does think that this is the right way, that this is going to be better for everyone, and that this is what everyone wants. Whereas in the comic, it just feels like it's more purely entertainment on his part.
Yeah, that's essentially what I was going to say, too.
Definitely far more tragic in the live action.
I ended up liking that version. I guess we probably already said this, but I ended up liking that version of John a lot better, the TV show version, because of those things.
That actor is so perfect. Like, obviously, he's the one that played Remus Lupin in Harry Potter, and I liked him because of that, even though I don't actually necessarily like him as Remus Lupin, but I really just liked his performance in this. I thought it was, like, spot on perfect.
Yeah, for sure.
Just because I think that the answer probably relates to this particular episode we've been talking about, but are there things elements that you found more disturbing in the show or the comic? Or did you find anything disturbing in the show versus the comic? And if so, what parts were those?
Oh, well, the diner scene for sure. That was great.
An interesting thing that I felt after both of them is I think they both are violent. But despite thinking the show is less horror, I feel like the show is gorier. And mostly just because of the way that the amulet seems to work for John, where if anybody tries to hurt him, it just like liquefies them and makes them into a big old goo puddle. So I don't know. I thought that was interesting.
In case you're wondering what your gal wants in terms of jewelry, that's it.
Christmas shopping complete.
Yes, please.
I was going to say something other than like 24/7. That obviously is a pretty disturbing one. But something that happens, I think, in the first issue is that Dream, maybe it's the first or second, but Dream like makes it so that when people see other people, that they perceive them as like these horrible, scary fear monster kind of things in the comic book. And I don't think that was in the show at all, but I thought that was pretty frightening in the comic books. It's almost like they were trying to make it like Scarecrow, because Scarecrow obviously is a DC property too, but like if in the Christian Bale Batman movies, how he makes it so people see him in a scarier way or see their worst fears.
You know, something that they kind of left out of the TV show that I kind of wish they would have included is also the effect that Dream's absence had on the world. They touched on it like a little bit, but they devoted pages and pages to it in the comic of how while Dream was locked up, it was like psychologically torturing people across the world, which I thought was a really cool, well, I don't know if cool is the right word, but a really interesting horror element that I think could have made the TV show a little bit more horror, because that was part of the comic to me that felt very horror, that because Dream is away, then everybody's sleep is either taken from them or they can no longer wake up from it. And that just causes chaos in the world. And to me, that's pretty horrifying. I wish they would have put more of that in the TV show. It would have made it darker, I think.
I like in the comics how they specifically followed specific people over years or generations, and how his absence like messed them up on a personal level.
So I watched through the whole series, and the thing that's fun about the series too, at least as far as the TV series goes, is they released a random bonus episode, which I'm excited to watch. I haven't watched it yet. That would be episode 11 for this. But I did watch through all of the series that there was at the time, going to episode 10. I didn't want to spoil anything heavily for that, since we specifically said that we're going to episode 6. But I will at least say that the consequences of him being imprisoned and the idea of the effects that it had on the world is explored a little bit more on the back half of the television series.
This is good to know, because that was something in the comic that I found very interesting, and I wanted it to be more touched on in the show, so I'm good. I'm going to have to watch the next 4 episodes now. Well, 5 episodes.
You'll have to tell us if you feel like you're satisfied with at least what they do give you. But yeah, there is more, so there's that, I will say.
Because the idea of not being able to sleep for years is pretty horror to me. I would turn you into a walking zombie.
So I guess at least one of the things I wanted to touch on, you get the Corinthian in both the comic series and in the TV series, but at least one of the differences between the two is that in the show he shows up almost immediately and has a big presence during this first arc, whereas in the comic series you don't meet him until the second volume. If you do see him in the first volume, I think it's really just only in passing. But I was curious how that character came across. I mean, he seems like a character that should be out of a horror movie, right? We've got someone who's got no eyes and teeth for eyes, and who's, you know, at least somewhat gleeful serial killer. So we've got that type of horror character, horror element in the series, and so, but we all said no. So why wasn't that enough to push it over?
Probably because for me, he's not the only antagonist. Like, there's other things going on and other people who are working against the great scheme of things here. So it wasn't enough to make it horror, but Corinthian himself is definitely a horror, body horror character specifically. Like, the eyes freak me out every time. And I also feel like the comic portrayals also might freak me out a little bit more, because there's a lot of frames where you can just kind of study the evil that they drew into that character's face. And he's absolutely rooted in horror. I mean, he's a nightmare made incarnate, right? So, and he eats eyeballs. I mean, that's horror.
So I guess my comments on him will come with a disclaimer that I haven't gotten to the bit in the comic where he's actually there. I haven't read the second volume yet. I'm excited to. That's one of my next reads. But for the show, I thought it was felt a little out of place to bring him in early, as from the get-go. And I had a hard time ending up taking him that seriously. They portray him as somebody you're supposed to be worried about, but then, like, when you get down to it, like, he's really lucky in several circumstances. Like, he's really lucky that Dream didn't have just a couple more seconds to reabsorb him at the very beginning. He's really lucky that Dream didn't happen to be in the dreaming when he ends up back there. The other thing that bothered me about it is, like, if he was supposed to be there from the beginning, then, like, he had, like, a century to do something about this, to, like, get prepared for Dream to be back. Because, like, if he was a smart character, then he would have known that eventually he's going to have to deal with Dream. Like, be that in 5 years, 10 years, a century, but whatever. But he didn't do anything until Dream was actually back. And then he's like, oh, well, I better put some ducks in a row and try and go figure out the ruby. All that being said, is just had a hard time taking him seriously. So I didn't end up finding him scary or anything like that. He's obviously supposed to be a horror character, but it all that took too much away from me to like really feel like he was actually scary.
Look, the Corinthian is struggling with procrastination. He is working on it. He is growing as a nightmare. You need to be a little bit more supportive.
That's true. I'm sorry.
He's just living his best life, doing the best he can. We all know that.
That's right.
I do agree with Joe, though, that at least in the first six episodes, it feels like he doesn't really do anything. Just kind of there in the background and, like, you know. It almost feels like, why did they introduce him this early in the show if he's not going to really, like, even do anything? But I get it.
Yeah.
I think at least part of what they were trying to accomplish with it, and whether or not it succeeded, your mileage may vary. I guess my personal feeling is it didn't accomplish it either, is they wanted to do the first and second volume as the first season. To make them seem cohesive, they wanted to have him throughout, but it didn't really work for me either. He felt a bit out of place in the section that he wasn't in the comic. And then, of course, you know, he works just fine in the back half that we didn't watch for the show. But at least to say for where he's introduced for the part that we did watch for the show, I feel like he almost comes across, again, it's an empathetic sort of character too, where he's almost... in that first sequence, kind of almost having that discussion with your maker. I mean, how many of us would have that kind of discussion if we believe in God, if we met God, and we had the opportunity to discuss, like, okay, you're upset with me because of my failings, because of the things I didn't do, or the things I did do that were wrong, but you made me like this. And in that way, he ends up being very kind of relatable on a core level that makes him not feel so horrific to me, despite being the type of serial killer that he is, which, I don't know. I mean, he's still doing terrible things, but I don't know. There's something about that core sort of existential dilemma within him that I think is relatable.
Yeah, I definitely see that angle. Makes him feel a little less scary too, especially that opening scene where he's kind of pleading with Dream a little bit.
So another angle that we did touch on a little bit as far as the violence in Sandman, the show versus Sandman, the comic. And I forget who said this, but they made the point that there's more gore in the TV show, but somehow the comic feels more violent. Did I get that right?
Well, I'd said that I feel like they're both violent, but the show is gory as well.
So I guess how did everybody feel about at least that aspect that's a traditional horror element is violence and gore? How did you feel about the portrayal of it in both versions of Sandman?
I mean, there was violence, but we've seen we've talked about a lot of different films and things that have violence, and I don't think that gore alone makes it a horror movie. So for me, even though gore was present in both the comic and the live action version, it was just kind of an element that existed in the universe that we were talking about. It wasn't gratuitous enough for me? Is that wrong? Like, there was no out-and-out torture. It's just not, I don't know. There was no axes in people's heads. Like, there were no chainsaws. These are things that I expect from a horror movie.
On the gore front, I don't know. I felt like it didn't necessarily put anything over the top for me horror-wise. I kind of felt more that the horror in the comic was not like maybe a traditional horror, like I don't know, it's not like Halloween or Freddy and Jason kind of horror. It's, I think we've kind of talked about, like maybe like gothic horror kind of a thing. Like there's this area where fantasy starts flirting with horror. And that's kind of where the comic is for me. And I think that wasn't really because of the gore either way. So, yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. I know that was a weird point, but yeah, there we go.
Yeah, I don't think the gore in either one of these is what made it horror for me. Like I said, I don't think it's horror. But I did mention that I thought episode 5, 24/7... of the TV show was horror, but for me it wasn't because of the gore, even though that was the goriest episode. For me, that episode was horror because it was psychological horror. The idea that these people no longer had the ability to lie, they had to tell the truth and were being controlled to tell the truth, that's what made it horror for me rather than the gore. And the gore was just adding to that.
Yeah, I agree with that, especially within the comic too.
Complete shift without a clutch. I've been sitting here trying to figure out if there's a skunk outside or if someone's rolling absolutely terrible weed, and I'm sad to say it is definitely a skunk. The PSA is now over. Oh my god.
It's like skunk smoking.
It is so bad. It is a skunk smoking a freaking blunt. It has to be. It's so bad.
Is that horror?
That is horror. Horrible. Especially, yeah, that is horror.
Yeah, when a skunk puffs, but doesn't pass, that's definitely horror.
Fucking rude.
Just hand it over. It's not that difficult. Come on, skunk.
I know, man. Sharing's caring. Hello.
Well, another thing I wanted to touch on a little bit, too, because obviously we've talked plenty about episode 5, but to hit on some of the other elements and some of the other episodes/issues, I wanted to talk a little bit about Hell and the Devil and the portrayal of both of those elements in both the comic and the TV series. So it's not necessarily a Christian version of Hell, but I think at least all of us are, whether we are or aren't now, are at least acquainted with Christianity. So I guess how did that episode play for you? Did that approach any sort of horror elements from the taboo of dealing with that place, that subject matter, that person? How did that feel?
I think it was portrayed awesome. It was creepy. That was horror flavored for me. But I do think it was a very Christian type hell, because to me, some of those things felt like it was like right out of Dante's Inferno to me. And it's been a while since I've read it, but like I got that very classical hell feeling from those scenes.
Yeah, I felt that was one of the ones that I felt was more like that kind of gothic horror style where you are dueling with the devil, like literally face to face. I also kind of think that that whole scene was a little bit hurt in the TV show by having Matthew be there. And it kind of just felt a little bit cheesy that, like, during the duel he was saying the things and, like, getting weakened and, like, on the ground, and Matthew had to give him a pep talk to get through it. Like, I don't know. I didn't buy that part of it. I didn't like it
nearly as much as the comic. You didn't buy the plucky sidekick? Come on.
No, I really didn't like it. And also, the whole time when we're saying Matthew, I keep thinking of Stan by Eminem. You could have signed an autograph for Matthew.
Okay, so this might be a hot take, but ironically, the portrayal of hell in both the comic and the TV show pulled it more away from horror and pushed it more towards fantasy for me. Because to me, the way that hell was portrayed was like a fantasy realm almost. It was like a kingdom of its own, kind of like the dream realm was a kingdom of its own. So to me, it kind of felt like it didn't feel scary. It just felt like a universe, you know what I mean? Does that make sense? Like, it has its own lore, and to me, they could have went a whole different direction with hell, but to me it just felt like a creepy realm of magical demonic creatures.
Yeah,
first of all, Satan was too well dressed for me to be afraid of them, like, straight up.
Oh yeah.
Great cloak, love the shoulder pads, epaulettes are life. But I was not afraid.
I don't know if they meant for Lucifer to be scary, though.
I don't think so, but I also, I want to be a little bit scared of Satan, because he's Satan. I mean, I don't want a South Park Satan. He's great, but not in my horror. I want Viggo Mortensen from The Prophecy as my Satan. That's one of my favorite Satans.
But I think, like I said, I don't know if this is a hot take or not, but I think that, one, I don't think they were meaning to. I think that what this comic has done is just kind of subvert all these ideas we have of these entities. Like, Satan is not this scary creature. It's just the leader of this afterlife. Just like death is not this scary evil creature. She's actually a very kind being who beckons these people into the next, you know, wherever they go. The sunless lands, exactly. So I think, you know, this comic kind of tries to portray all these scary things as neutral. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree, honestly, because I think it does just feel like a different fantasy realm rather than, you know, the this representation of hell. It feels just more like an alternate dimension filled with malevolent things, which maybe that's splitting hairs, but I think that there is a tangible difference. I think that the comic hits on it a little bit better. There's that sort of lumpy, surrealist version of the artwork that happens in comics during that era that lends itself better towards this depiction of hell. And it's not extremely different, but it does get a little bit more sanitized for the show, which the comic does a better job of approaching a horror feel to it. Whereas, yeah, the show takes the same essential story elements, traveling path, and it ends up feeling more fantasy than anything for me. And I agree with what Matt said. I think the way that the duel was portrayed didn't really work for me as well as it did in the comic. Plus, in the comic, they have Satan as David Bowie, which, I mean, no offense to the actress that played Satan. She did great, but, I mean, obviously Bowie was unavailable. So what are you going to do?
I'm going to have to go back and look at that now, because I guess I didn't draw that connection.
Yeah, I was just gonna say I agree with that too about the duel, because I could almost picture, at least in the comic book portrayal, their duel from the outside looking in might have just looked like both of them standing there looking at each other, and all the whole battle was just taking place in their like combined psyche. And so like nobody from the outside might have even known what was going on until it was over. But I like that idea a little bit better than how it was portrayed in the show with him like, oh yeah, scratched in the face, falling on the ground, all that stuff. And then the other thing for me is like the stakes didn't feel very high for Dream in Hell, because he always felt like kind of outside of it, you know, because like we've said, like this was another realm, and like he like presents himself as like, I'm the king of this other place, and you know, I'm a guest here sometimes. And like the other it's like it's a comic book called The Sandman, and I'm pretty sure in the first he's not going to get trapped in Hell for eternity in the fourth issue of this, you know, comic book. So the stakes weren't very high in that regard for me either.
Okay, this is a random plug for a comic that's been canceled for 2.5 decades now. But man, there was a... Okay, so back in the 90s, DC was doing this thing where they had the rights to this group of superheroes that were originally owned by the Archie Comics publishing company. And so those characters, one of them was included, was the Black Hood. And they'd already started out this shared universe line, so they had these superheroes. They had the Comet, the Web, the Jaguar, the Fly, and the Shield, and they started out with just those. Each of those characters had their own series. So then they announced they're going to have another series called The Black Hood, and they have the Black Hood guest star in every one of those characters' comics, all leading up to his first issue. And then the first issue, again, spoilers for a 2.5 decade comic, the first issue they kill him. And it's not like he's a ghost and he comes back or they resurrect him. No, he's flat out dead. Like, he shows up in the first...
Oh my god, they Ned Starked him.
Oh my gosh.
It was amazing, because then you find out, yeah, the story is about the person who wears the hood, because the hood is somewhat enchanted, and the person that you are going to follow is introduced in that issue. But man, it took me by surprise, because at the time, like, I wasn't more jaded with reading comics because everything was fresh and new, even though it had been 1,000 times that it's done already. But like hitting that up for me, that was just, oh man, it hit me like a Mack truck, because I was not expecting it all. So anyway, just made me think of that. Yeah, I agree. Fourth issue of a series, they're not going to abandon it to hell forever, but it just reminds me of that comic, because that was really unexpected.
Well, that's interesting.
So we have touched on this as well, and I wanted to at least discuss this a little bit, because there's other elements we could talk about through any of the individual episodes. But so episode 6, The Sound of Her Wings, we get Dream and Death having their conversation basically about the value of life. What do you do with your life? Which is not a conversation you expect to be having with Death. And then, of course, Death's personification is a much cheerier person than you would expect. You know, you'd think in any other series we'd be talking about Death and that it'd be the most horrific episode. But I guess for me, at least in thinking about it, it was the least horrific episode. That was the episode that was the absolute furthest from horror, was the one where we actually meet and follow Death. So I was curious how that played for each of you, if maybe just the idea of it being Death, if that lent anything towards the horror idea, or if you kind of reacted the same way I did.
That was one of... That is so far my favorite episode and issue. I thought it was great. And I had the same reaction. Like, there was, for me, no horror elements in that episode. It was just a really pretty and empathetic story. And I really loved how that was all portrayed.
Yeah, there were too many feels in that episode for it to ever qualify as horror. However, it is the episode where, like you said, you get to meet Death, and she's definitely not what you expect. And I think that's the point. Like, yeah. I think that's what's being driven home. And I can't quote it, but I think she says something to the effect of, to Dream, She's like, yeah, you know, they all love you and you basically make their life miserable half the time. And I'm just here to provide a little bit of relief and girl can't get any thanks. Like that was the vibe I got from it. And I just thought that was so powerful. I don't know. Like, hey, you want to take a nap for a couple hundred years? Come on, let's go to the endless place or whatever it's called.
Yeah, a couple things I wrote down, a couple lines from that that I wrote down that really kind of hit me. Were like, you know, Dream says, why do they fear the sunless lands? And then the other was like, I'm much more terrible than you, sister. Both those lines hit me hard and just kind of were really interesting to me.
I already loved this issue of the comics, The Sound of Her Wings. Is that what it's called?
Yes.
I'm not sure.
Yes.
But I think the TV show did it very well. I think they definitely did the issue justice because I cried during the TV show. As someone who has lost someone like within the past few years, very close to me. Yeah, that was a very, very emotional episode, but also very comforting in a way. It definitely does force you to reconsider the concept of death and what death really is, whether it should be feared or not. I hope there's a hot girl to usher me into the afterlife.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to be said for, I forget what Steve was saying earlier about how the show seemingly takes different tropes and kind of throws them on their head, like death would normally be something scary, but the show works towards making it like she's performing the service and is a friendly face that holds our hand as we go into it, and that's her purpose. And she just reminds Death that they're not doing a job or a labor, they're performing a service, and that's kind of like very powerful. And the whole like how friendly and happy she is to be there with them for that is something that's very strong.
I think maybe that episode and issue are a big part of why I think, at least up to this point for me, that the whole series isn't in the horror format for me, because it's just, I guess, horror, not that it can't be empathetic or thoughtful or whatever, like definitely horror can be that, but this has maybe just more of that, and it's more, I don't know, just more introspective about death in general, instead of just like, oh, you're getting hacked up with by a machete or whatever. Like, I don't know. Even I don't think they showed it as much in the show, but in the comic book, like she visits a few violent deaths, but you know, it's not dwelt on, and it is just like, no matter what the death was, she's just there to greet them by holding out her hand and smiling at them and, I don't know, ushering them into the afterlife. So, I don't know, that just, in a really good way, takes the whole series for me away from horror.
I think one of the things about both the show and the comic, and maybe you feel a little bit more in the show, at least for the sections that we've, again, always disclaimer, section that we've watched, section that we've read, is maybe hit on really with A Hope in Hell, when he says at the end of the day, you know, what is hell without hope? But just that he brings up hope as the thing that even the devil can't figure out how to crush, and ultimately depends on, at least in that realm. And so I think that you get this whole thing throughout the whole series where the tone is very hopeful for people, and that they can be better, and willing to see them as humans even when they're not, and just trying to understand the decisions that they're making more than to vilify them for those decisions. And I think with that at the core, for me at least, of the tone of the TV series, it's hard for it to ever really feel like horror, because it's not to say that horror can't explore hope on that level, but it is territory that it tends not to tread as much in. Now, obviously, if you're a listener and you think you have examples to the contrary, bring them on. I'd be interested to check them out. But I just think that's not usually the underlying tone that you get a lot with horror.
Well, what power would the fear of being killed in a horror movie have if there was no hope of survival?
Trick question, there is no hope. I really did enjoy the memes that I saw of like the frame of the actor playing Dream being like, and what kills hope? And then Lucifer's like, student debt, high interest credit card rating, homeowners associations rules and fees. It's like, yeah, accurate.
Going back to work on Monday.
Going back to work on Monday.
All right. One of the other things I guess I wanted to touch on a little bit is just the idea too with, we talk about tension a lot when it comes to horror, and I think we've at least hit on a little bit that some of the tension maybe didn't feel as palpable, maybe is the word I'll go for. But anyway, that the tension isn't as high here, but part of that has to do with the stakes of it. I mean, you watch somebody who's basically sealed up in a bubble for almost a century and they're just fine. So I guess, is it more difficult to feel tension for characters that are essentially immortal? Is it also difficult to feel tension for some of the characters if you feel like they weren't maybe sympathetic? So does that hurt it towards feeling like horror?
Yeah, I do have a harder time with the stakes when the character is immortal and can't be killed by a stake, like through the heart kind of deal.
I guess that was the thing, like, it was hard for me to picture, like, I mean, they wanted you to, like, feel worried about Dream and that, you know, he might die, or, like, when he jumps in the water, oh, the dreams are stronger and they're getting to him, but, like, what does that mean for an immortal being who's the king of this land? Like, I don't even know what that means or what the risks are for him, if there are actually risks for him.
I think it goes back to what Mitch said about showing the effect that Dream's imprisonment had on, like, the waking world. I think that would have invested me more.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point.
I guess one of the things, too, that I was thinking about in terms of the show is whether or not it does really fall into or try to use any horror tropes. Certainly at least some during 24/7, but I guess if there was any that came to mind, any that you noticed that stuck out to you during the course of the series?
We already talked about it a little bit, but another tense moment for me, I guess, kind of maybe because I read the comic book first, but leading up to that diner scene, just the way the like car ride with John and Rosemary, because I knew how it ended in the comic book, and there was enough different in the show that I like wasn't positive that's how it was going to end. But like just that whole lead up was very tense for me, and I liked how it ended up better. I don't know if it felt better, but yeah, that was, anyways, I said that already, but that was tense for me.
Yeah, I agree. That was very much one of the more tense moments of the show. Especially with the, like, if we're talking about horror tropes, the escape, the mental asylum escapee.
Yeah, definitely
there.
You could tell they definitely planned it with the idea that people would be expecting something there. Especially when he leaves Rose is her name, right?
Rosemary,
you could tell that they knew that people were going to expect something to happen there, so they flipped that on its head just for the show.
I'm sure they got a lot of flack for that, too.
It's possible, and like it was certainly a change, but I don't know. I ended up, like, I mean, we talked about it already, but I liked that better. It made John, it felt more consistent with who John's character was in the show. Like, again, like, he's not trying to be the bad guy. He's not that chaotic evil. He's like, well, mm-hmm. you're cool enough, Rosemary. Here's this amulet. See you later.
And what he says when he gives her it is like, keep this so nobody can hurt you, kind of shows that in this version of the story, he does have a sense of justice.
Yeah. I was worried for the dog, though.
Always worried for any dog in any horror.
Yes.
So I think that for the most part, we've hit on all the topics that I kind of had in mind to discuss, but obviously there's a lot to go into in that first volume. There's a lot to go into in the 6 episodes of a television series. So I wanted to see if there was anything else that people wanted to discuss that we haven't hit on yet, or just any other thoughts that came to mind that you wanted to make sure we shared.
I don't know if I have a lot of specific things, but I guess just to say, like, I'm late to the game on this where I haven't actually read this before, but I'm really loving it. Like, I feel like it's a really good, really introspective, series, and it's talking about a lot of things, and I'm just excited to read more and watch more. I guess one thing that it's just as far as Dream's character that I found kind of interesting is, like, he's a, like, empathetic character or sympathetic or whatever, but, like, it's more on, like, a macro scale. In the episode with Constantine, you know, he doesn't seem very concerned with how he leaves Constantine's girlfriend, I forget her name, but, like, then later he's just going to leave her there to kind of suffer and die. But then later when he's fighting John, he has the line where he's like, he's really concerned about, he's like, you're hurting the dreamers. Like, stop what you're doing. You're hurting the dreamers. And he's a lot more worried about, like, kind of, at least I read that as he's worried about humanity as a whole. Not very much on an individual level, but he's not even like, oh, you're hurting me. You're hurting the dreamers. Anyways, I thought that was an interesting just character note, character development kind of thing.
Which I guess that would make sense too, because if you were endless, if you had existed for all of time that existed, I think you'd almost have to take it to that macro level, because if you started getting involved in every person's little issues and day-to-day existence, it would be too much. You could end up spending an entire lifetime making sure one person's situation was okay to the detriment of billions of people. So yeah, I guess that's not something I had thought about in that context, but yeah, I think you'd have to look at it on the macro scale to be able to do his job.
Yeah. Which is an interesting thing. I didn't think about that till you said that, but, like, it's interesting when you take that idea and apply it to death as well, because it does feel like she takes it on a personal level and she interacts with people on a personal level, but Dream is more above, or not above that, but just like scaled up a little bit. I don't know, just macro level, I guess.
Something I was going to note, and I should probably preface this by saying I'm not really much of, like, a superhero fan. I don't particularly enjoy superhero movies / media. Please don't murder me for that, okay? Because I know that's huge right now. But so I'm not sure if this is a superhero thing, or maybe this is a Neil Gaiman thing. I don't know. But I found it very interesting that all of these different fantasy worlds were, like, kind of just smushed into the same universe. So we've got the personification of Dream, Destiny, Desire, Death, etc. And then we've got the heaven and hell thing with demons and, I assume, angels also. But then we've got the Fates, who are from mythology, the three Fates. Not just Greek mythology, but just they pretty much show up in all mythology. And then this is a DC story, so then we've also got superheroes. So it's like an amalgamation of just all these different fantasy worlds together. And I think it puts so much emphasis on all of that that it takes away the horror of it. And it's just this, like, extreme, I don't know, fantasy fiction, Neil Gaiman, mushy, I don't know. It's just everything's together.
It might be a Neil Gaiman thing because American Gods, like, yeah, I'm seeing some parallels here.
Yeah, I think that there's... Well, there's a couple things rolling around my head, at least with that comment. So, yeah, the first thing is I did think of American Gods as well because there's a whole idea of people's beliefs sort of creating these things, taking them with them, or at least creating having some sort of ownership.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wonder if, at least for Neil Gaiman, that's at least part of it. And the other side of it, too, is that's at least somewhat the world that he had to deal with within comics because... there's a whole idea, at least with writing, and I'm probably getting at least somewhat wrong, but that if you're going to have some sort of fantastical element, that it should all spawn from the same place, right? So if you're doing, you know, if you're creating Harry Potter's universe, then their concept is just magic is real and everything springs forth from there, but you're not adding in, like, there's also sentient robots running around and fighting people from the future or something like that, right? So it's the one thing. And you get that when you do these sort of changes sometimes in superhero fiction where they take the comic source where the hero and the villain have very different origins from all over the place. And at least this is more superheroes movies in the 90s, mind you, not nowadays, but where they'll say, okay, well, let's have the same accident create both the hero and the villain, and then they can fight against each other so the audience doesn't have to buy into numerous origins for powers. They just have to buy into one thing. This event happened, it created both things. But then when you have superhero comics with so many years, there's so many different concepts, so many different ideas all rattling around, all running into each other, that there's just a lot of stuff. So I think Neil Gaiman, with his feelings on mythology and wanting to use those as sources, is already looking at those things through his sort of American God lens, we'll say, but then also writing for a superhero comic that already has so many different mythologies all ramming up against each other and taking different interpretations that it was easy to just throw that into the mix.
Not to mention, I totally forgot to mention Cain and Abel being there too. Like,
yeah,
we're just throwing it all together and mixing it up.
Yeah.
I would say Steven already said this, but DC is particularly famous for, like, having all kinds of crazy stuff, comic bookized, like, you know, all these different mythologies and things like that. So, yeah, it's not surprising to me that they'll add in all these obscure concepts now into DC canon.
Anything goes.
Whereas, meanwhile, the... from this TV show maybe tries to streamline it at least a little bit because it leaves all the superhero stuff out of it.
Mm-hmm. Which worked a lot better for me. I told Steve this a little bit, but like I kind of went into this reading this book a little bit blind. I didn't know that it was this tied into the DC stuff. So like every time the comic book stuff or the, that's kind of the DC stuff came up, like, it always took me by surprise, even though I should have learned my lesson from each time it came up, because they're like, oh, you know, John's in Arkham. And, you know, I sat there thinking to myself, oh, that's a fun little nod to the DC universe. And I was like, oh, no, it's actually Arkham that that he's going to. And yeah. Or like, oh, you've got to go talk to the JLA to track this thing down. I was like, oh, that's interesting. He's going to be like a, like, is that just like a obscure reference for, oh, they've got to go, he's got to go talk to like some comic book geek or something like that. But no, he's actually literally got to go talk to the JLA. Every time one of those things came up, it just always took me by surprise. It was just weird for me that it was even in there, and it worked. The show worked a lot better for me that they took all that out.
And even in the comic, when they're talking about like JLA or other superheroes, it's like obscure stuff. I mean, Martian Manhunter's in it like a little bit, but then it's like I had to look up some who the other people were that were in the comic that it was referring to or that he was talking to.
So are we basically in agreement that the TV series is set separately from the DC universe? Because they changed John Constantine too, like completely. So, I don't know. Is it meant to be completely separate?
I haven't heard anyone officially say, but at least in my mind, the sheer fact that it is being aired by Netflix when HBO, owned by Warner Brothers, is basically the home of every other DC property. So I think that it being on Netflix is a way to signal that, yeah, this is not going to inhabit the DC universe. It is its own separate thing.
Interesting. I don't really have an opinion on it either way. I think it's definitely interesting enough to be a standalone thing, so no complaints for me.
Yeah, I think it works better on its own. Any other thoughts before we wrap things up?
I was just going to add one more bit to that. In the comic, when it does bring up stuff that's related adjacently to the DC universe, it sort of feels like out of place brand placement. It was almost like, hey, Neil, since you're doing this under our name, you got to throw in these little like adjacent references that don't make a ton of sense. Here they go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us on our bonus episode of Is It Horror? The season proper will start on October 1st with our first episode of season 2, which will be Hot Fuzz. And also to make mention, we are going to be having our first annual Is It Horror Movie Marathon. And so that'll be 5 weeks of horror movies, each following a theme for each of those weeks. And so it starts a little bit outside of October. It'll start on September 25th. It'll end on October 31st. The first week will be classic cults. So it'll all be films that deal with cults instead of the, you know, not cult classics, but some of them will be. And then ending, as I said, on October 1st with Hot Fuzz, which will be the episode that we release. That'll be dealing with whether or not that's horror. And we'll be releasing weekly throughout the month of October, so you can look forward to that. But otherwise, thank you for joining us. And I know Sandman is such a dense topic. There are so many other things we could have talked about with the TV show, so many things we could have talked about with the comic. And we might revisit some of this later to see how we feel as the series progresses. But thank you for bearing with us, and apologize if we didn't touch on the thing that you thought we should have or your favorite thing about it, but feel free to message us that, and maybe we can address it in the future. So thanks for joining us. I have been Steve.
And I'm Brianna.
I'm Joe.
I'm Matt.
And I'm Mitz.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's do the same bye at the end.
Bye.
Bye.
Y'all sound like seagulls. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us at Is It Horror? We post new episodes every other Friday. Think we didn't give this movie a fair shake? Think we missed something? Do you have a suggestion for future episodes? Or did you just want to say hi? If so, you can follow us on Twitter or Instagram at Is It Horror Pod. Or you can email us at isithorrorpodcast@gmail.com. In the meantime, stay safe and keep asking yourself,
Is It Horror?